This is Arthur from True Suspense, and you are listening to our Season 6 story, The Great Deceiver. Here is Episode 2, Big Plans, Big Promises. Prologue. Mr. and Mrs. Seeger owned a business and some property in Georgia. Mr. Seeger worked very hard at building the business, and Mrs. Seeger stayed at home raising the children. When the business slowed down and the Seegers started to struggle, they decided to sell much of their property and use the cash proceeds to make new investments. Mr. Seeger was befriended by a man named Justin Costello. As Mrs. Seeger would later put it, her husband was made to think Costello was just this, quote, wonderful, knowledgeable, brilliant businessman, unquote. Her husband quickly came to trust Justin Costello and thought they were good friends. And so when Costello devised a plan for their investments that held the promise of large returns at low risk, the Seegers went along to the tune of putting almost everything they owned into the investments guided by Costello. In a pattern repeated elsewhere, it did not take long before the investments went south. Eventually, the Seegers were left with almost nothing. Mrs. Seeger went back to work to try to make ends meet. Mr. Seeger was totally devastated and utterly embarrassed. In the words of Mrs. Seeger, quote, "After my husband realized that Costello was a fraud and lost all of our money, he became inconsolable. He withdrew, became verbally abusive, and it was awful. He went from a wonderful father to a man we didn't recognize. He couldn't even get a job. He was so depressed," unquote. On March 4, 2022, the Seeger's daughter, returning from college, arranged to go see Mr. Seeger while her mom was at work. She and her dad had made a lunch date. When the daughter arrived, she went in, only to find her father lying dead. He had shot himself in the head. The date is September 6, 2017, and a leading publication of the cannabis industry, MJ Biz Daily, ran an article entitled, quote, "Washington State Broker Aims to Sell Bundle of 12 Marijuana Retailers for Up to $70 Million," unquote. The so-called broker in question was none other than Justin Costello. Here is how the article started out. Quote, "A dozen marijuana retail businesses in Washington State are employing an unusual strategy on the mergers and acquisitions front. Package their assets together for a combination sale. In a move that's being described as, quote, unprecedented, Seattle-based investment bank GRN Funds is asking $60 to $70 million for the 12 retail cannabis firms. GRN Funds CEO Justin Costello, who's brokering the sale and claims he's spearheaded 80-plus cannabis deals, said the businesses are located throughout Washington State, but most are in the Seattle area. He wouldn't reveal the retailers' names because of a non-disclosure agreement," unquote. The article went on to quote Costello directly speaking about why the retailers want to sell. Quote, They're just looking to exit out of the industry and enjoy their lives. That's the American dream, right? Build something big and sell it, or do an acquisition deal and make tens of millions of dollars, unquote. According to the article, Costello said he so far had about 150, quote, serious people inquire and had interest from around the United States as well as Canada and Asia, including inquiries from Singapore and Hong Kong. We now know that Justin Costello was not exactly a purveyor of truth, and you will notice how convenient it was that Costello supposedly could not reveal the names of the retailers involved due to a non-disclosure agreement. You may have also noticed that this was almost 2 years before he would tell Jim and Brenda Meckley that he was starting to put this deal together. As of the date of the article in 2017, he was only just beginning to carry out his fraudulent schemes, as far as we can tell. But MJ Biz, where the article appeared, prized itself on being, according to its website, quote, the most trusted media brand serving the business side of the cannabis and hemp industries in the U.S., Canada, and globally, unquote. But like so many others, the publication assumed Justin was the real deal. An explanation of how even knowledgeable people could be taken in appeared, with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, in an opinion piece published 4 years later by Marijuana Venture, a publication that calls itself the Journal of Professional Cannabis Retailers and Growers. The writer of the piece, Greg James, is the founder of the publication, and he addressed the puzzle of people falling for Justin Costello. He had this to say, quote, the bizarre thing about scammers is that they can spin an elaborate yarn that often works. Why? Because the folks who get sucked in are invariably hearing something they want to hear. Whether it's a journalist chasing a story or an investor looking for a get-rich-quick scheme, people can get swept up in the hype and bullshit of something they want to believe. Unquote. In a subsequent article in Marijuana Venture, author Brian Beckley led off with, quote, Justin Costello was well known in Washington's cannabis industry. He was a big personality with big plans, big money, and a big mouth, unquote. The tall tales that Costello told James and Brenda Meckley, as well as the Seegers, were repeated regularly to a great many people, albeit with occasional variations. He was a multimillionaire or a billionaire. He was the king of cannabis. He had an MBA from Harvard. He was a Wall Street whiz who ran a hedge fund. He was an investment advisor. He was a tycoon. He cavorted with Hollywood celebrities and Saudi sheikhs. And Costello did many things to play the part and be seen as a wealthy kingpin in the world of cannabis. He planted his supportive, fraudulent stories on many websites and all over social media. He also planted stories in legitimate online magazines. He even had a large, impressive downtown Seattle office at the time. Many of the things Costello did to play-act his role might be good for laughs if it weren't for all the victims he left in his wake. For example, in 2018, a story came out with the following headline, quote, history will be made as first ever $10,000 Canagar is sold, unquote. What is a Canagar, you may ask? Well, it's a pre-rolled cannabis product that is made in the shape of a cigar. The word is a mashup of the words cannabis and cigar. It is made by tightly compacting cannabis into a core hollowed down the middle to provide for airflow. Canagars differ from joints by how big they are and the materials from which they are constructed. So how in the world could a Kanagar cost $10,000, and who on earth would pay that amount? Well, you probably have guessed the answer to the second question. Justin Costello paid that. A high-profile, high-end pot dispensary in Seattle had created a 15-inch Kanagar featuring a full ounce of organic flower and wrapped in 24-karat gold leaf. It was sealed in a wax-capped glass tube inside a custom humidor with fancy accessories, including a cutter and a lighter. So word went out that someone was set to buy the item, and it caused quite a stir in the cannabis community. The actual sales transaction drew a crowd just as Costello knew it would, and he did not disappoint. After the sale was completed, he invited all those assembled to join him and the owner of the dispensary at a penthouse nearby. The crowd was delighted when, after Costello lit up the massive spliff and inhaled a deep puff for the cameras, he then sent it around for everyone to sample. A journalist reporting on the event for the website Leafly took one puff and described it this way, quote, "Body high, face high, mind high, sparkling in utter harmony, tingly fingertips and giggles on the bus ride home," unquote. To understand how Justin Costello carried out the theft of tens of millions of dollars from unsuspecting victims, it helps to do a little bit deeper dive into the cannabis industry in the state of Washington. I called upon a leading expert in the state, a scientist and a businesswoman with a deep understanding of the cannabis market there. Here is part of my interview with her. Jessica Tonanni is the CEO of VertaBio, a cannabis research company in the state of Washington, which she co-founded. VertaBio is performing genomic, analytical, and agricultural research on cannabis. She also co-founded Basic Jane with her friend Kirsten in 2014, when Jessica and Kirsten were approached by Kirsten's 80-year-old mom about whether their research company, VertaBio, could develop anything for her chronic arthritis pain. So, Jessica, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
So, you're a biotechnology professional with a strong background in the life sciences, and you're an entrepreneur who has founded multiple companies. Can you talk to us briefly about your career path and how you ended up in the world of cannabis?
You bet. It's a little bit twisted, I would say. So I started really traditional biotech, mostly in the human genomics space right out of grad school. Worked for companies that were doing things like tiling genomes on computer chips or sequencing genomes, those kind of things. And about 25 years ago, I also had some health struggles, and I had utilized cannabis for weight management while I waited to get into a clinical trial, and it had worked really well for me, but I realized it was not really a regulated medical system at the point at that time. And so given those two data points, when you fast forward through my career, about 10 years ago, I was co-founder of a company that was acquired. We built a DNA sequencer, and when that company was acquired, legalization in the state of Washington was also occurring around cannabis. So I found myself without a job and fairly interested still in the plant that I had utilized for weight management. And so I convinced some friends that we should do an ag bio company around the plant. And so our initial goal was to do clinical research on the compounds found within the cannabis plant. And We still are heading towards that goal, but we realized along the way that we really had to kind of step back and do a lot of the basic ag bio research that needed to be done on the plant. So we've been doing that for several years now. We were actually issued the first cannabis research license by a state in the country, and we've been proudly doing research ever since.
Cool. And then in the meantime, you and your friend Kirsten put together a CBD company selling CBD products. Is that right?
Exactly. It's completely right. And so a lot of people don't realize that the cannabis genome of plants has plants that produce THC that are oftentimes referred to as marijuana and undergo like tight regulatory regulation. And then there's a separate legal status of something called hemp, and hemp plants have less than 0.3% THC and are well known for compounds like CBD that are utilized out of them. And so about 7-8 years ago, Kirsten's mom approached us and said, hey, I really have some chronic knee pain and I can't take any more Advil because I have kidney issues. And so can you girls do anything for me? And what we ended up doing was formulating some topical cream utilizing CBD from hemp, and it worked really well for her. And so we have spent the last several years developing out a whole product line of non-impairing cannabinoids that products that help people with generally aches, pains, rest, those kind of things.
I see. I was reading a piece that you wrote about your reaction when people ask you, what do you do for a living? Can you tell us about that?
You bet. It's one of those things that back when I was in the biotech field, people, when they asked me, what do you do? It was a really straightforward answer. Now when people ask me, I kind of hold my breath. And the reason is I get very different reactions from people. Sometimes people say, oh, that's awesome. You're going to be a billionaire. That's the best thing ever. And other times when people respond, they'll say things like, you're an idiot. You're going to be broke. Why would you research a drug?
Yeah.
And all other kinds of things. So it's a very controversial field that we're working in, and we get very, very different responses.
Interesting. I gather that being in the cannabis business is not easy. Am I right?
You're 100% right. It's a white-collar profession right now in the U.S., and it's a really extremely competitive emerging market, like most emerging markets are. And you need to stay on top of several, you know, interesting components. It's really fast-moving science on our front, but it's also rapidly changing legal environment. So states will change legal rules that have huge impacts on companies. It's also a market that is extremely highly regulated. So, for example, the room that I'm talking to you in right now, we have 6 cameras in because at all points in time, we have to be able to see people's heads, hands, and feet. So we're extremely regulated, which makes it a lot more difficult to do business, quite frankly.
Can you tell us a little bit more about those laws and regulations as far as what they do to doing business?
Yeah, you bet. Cannabis is literally one of the most regulated industries on the planet. It's an industry where every bank transaction is actually flagged, potentially for money laundering and audits. Very few banks actually will take cannabis money. It is dictated by pretty extreme legislation. You know, for example, I just mentioned the camera, but quite frankly, every thing that we do in our work is regulated to some way, shape, or form. There's also rules on top of those legislation, and the rules interpret how we do our business and what we do. In the state of Washington, we probably have some of the strictest legislation in the country, and that just has to do with the fact that we were one of the first states, and at the time that Washington legalized, I think that there was extremely high levels of concern around federal interference, that if we didn't get things set up right and highly regulated, that the federal government would interfere with the ability of the state to sell cannabis. And so it's an extremely regulated industry.
Yeah. Now, I know that the CBD business that you're in with the Basic Jane, you've explained that that's different than the pot business, the THC business, to get getting high. Is there a difference between those two under federal law? Is CBD legal even under federal law?
Yeah, so hemp is legal under federal law. In 2018, the Farm Bill legalized the growing and processing and sale of hemp products, which you can generate CBD products from. THC, however, are plants that are, marijuana, pot, whatever you want to call them. Those are plants that can contain greater than 0.3% THC, and those plants or products from those plants are highly regulated and cannot participate in things like interstate commerce or anything like that.
I see. Now, whether it's for CBD or THC, a business has to get the product from those who grow it, right? So is that one of the complications of the market?
Yes, it definitely is. In the state of Washington and dozens of other states, you can grow cannabis under license, but you cannot move the crop to another state. You cannot access federal banking. You're not allowed to export the crop or import the crop. And you can't access federal research grants, loans, or anything like that. There's a very uniform set of guidance and rules that you have to follow. And quite frankly, every state has slightly different rules and are essentially recreating the wheel every time they stand up a new market. Products manufactured from hemp are substantially easier. Those can cross state lines. Those are federally legal. And however, the hemp market still does have some regulatory hoops to jump through.
I see. Other than Justin Costello, legitimate people that have been going into the marijuana retail business in Washington, and particularly on the THC side, what kind of people are these? Are they basically mom and pop operations, or are they people with sophisticated business backgrounds, or what?
Yeah, so Washington's a bit unique in the sense that since we were one of the first states establishing the market. At the time of legalization, there was a huge concern around states violating federal laws. And so one of the concessions that was made was to limit the size and scope of businesses to prevent interstate trafficking or concerns that may lead to federal interference or blocking of this emerging market. And so this was accomplished by only allowing Washington state residents to access the license structure. And so this limited the businesses to only being able to be funded by Washington residents. Mm-hmm. So it, by and large, made the businesses relatively small based upon the regulatory structure. But inversely, you did see professionals entering the market. So you did have people that had worked at very large companies prior and knew what they were doing entering the market, but the size and scope of the businesses was limited to being fairly small based upon the regulatory status.
Got it.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, that explains a lot. This is all very helpful, so I really appreciate you joining us here on True Suspense, and I'm gonna include links to your Basic Jane and VertiBio websites in the show notes for listeners who might be interested in finding out more. But thanks again, really appreciate it.
I appreciate being on the show.
All right, thanks.
Thanks.
You'll hear a bit more from my interview with Jessica in a subsequent episode, including her comments about Justin Costello. Meanwhile, it should be clear from what Jessica has explained that Costello's claims of creating a, quote, cannabis conglomerate, brokering mergers and acquisitions of pot businesses, and being able to arrange banking and credit solutions for the industry were, at a minimum, flights of fancy. Those with the kind of deep understanding of the market and scientific and regulatory framework that Jessica Tonanni possesses would probably have realized that nobody would be in a position to work the kind of magic Costello was bragging about in such a highly regulated, complicated industry. But part of the appeal, perhaps, was that for people who were wanting to get financially involved in cannabis, but bewildered by all the hurdles and complexities, Justin Costello appeared to be the man who could take care of all of that. This included, among his many victims, people running some small, legitimate marijuana businesses that entered into agreements with Costello's Pacific Banking Corp to receive banking services. These marijuana businesses collectively gave Costello, through Pacific Banking Corp, many millions of dollars, shortly after which, and contrary to his promises, Costello began diverting a portion of the business's funds to his other companies and for his own personal benefit. One of the small pot businesses out of California, CCSAC Inc., filed a lawsuit in that state against Costello's banking company during March of 2020. The business owners declared that they had lost $3.3 million in dealing with Pacific Banking. But in that case, Costello filed a declaration claiming that about $3 million of the funds were in a secure bank account at Sound Credit Union in Tacoma, Washington. That, however, was utterly false. As it would later emerge, the bank account in question had a balance not of $3 million being held for CCSAC Inc., but of $15.35, barely enough for a small family to buy dinner at McDonald's. In a different kind of deceitful scheme, Justin Costello worked with a confederate named David Ferraro. This scheme involved stock manipulation through an approach called pump and dump. Between October 2019 and January 2021, Costello purchased large blocks of thinly traded penny stocks at very low prices. Costello recruited and paid David Ferraro to fraudulently promote or pump the stocks by making materially false statements concerning the companies. Ferraro controlled a Twitter account under the handle @computerbucks, Bucks spelled B-U-X. This had nearly 10,000 followers. Ferraro promoted himself as a so-called business transformation consultant, and as part of his regular tweets with stock tips, Ferraro raved about certain of the penny stocks bought on the cheap by Costello. As the stock's prices were increasing after unwitting investors purchased shares based on the fraudulent tweets, Costello sold or dumped his shares into the market at the artificially inflated prices and reaped significant profits. As soon as he sold large quantities of the shares of any given stock, of course, the price plummeted, leaving most of the other investors with significant losses. Costello continued to prey on various individuals and small businesses. Even as many of those who had trusted him began to panic as they saw their investments circling the drain, Costello was able to bilk still others with his various fraudulent schemes. And in the process, he was able to support an increasingly lavish lifestyle. Join us next time when we look at the question, as Costello was robbing people blind, where was law enforcement in all of this? That's coming up in The Great Deceiver, Episode 3, 25 Shades of Fraud. The Great Deceiver is a production of True Suspense Podcasts, written and narrated by me, Arthur Perlstein. Music, sound engineering, and post-production by Guy Bainbridge and Walls End Studios. Be sure to visit truesuspense.com for more information about this podcast and other True Suspense productions. If you like what you hear, please help spread the word. Don't forget to subscribe and rate us wherever you listen to the podcast. It helps new listeners find us. Thank you.